Let me dim this a bit. Too much?
It's okay now.
Okay. We were talking about light last time. Photons are, in a sense, particles of light. Remember, they're not material, though. They are just little packets of energy. Each photon is a packet of energy. And I think I've already told you that when a photon encounters an object, there's three possibilities, right? It can be transmitted, go straight through that object. It can be absorbed, or it can be reflected in a different direction. And if it gets absorbed, the photon ceases to exist. It no longer is there. But of course, the energy of that photon isn't destroyed. Energy can't be created or destroyed, as you know. So when a photon is absorbed, that means the energy goes into the thing absorbing the photon. And things that absorb photons we call pigments, like the pigments in photosynthesis. Under normal circumstances, meaning not in a plant or a cell, a living thing, just an isolated pigment molecule, the energy that's absorbed, the energy that enters the pigment when that photon gets absorbed by the pigment, excites the molecule. And by exciting it, what I mean is that an electron that's part of that pigment molecule gets sent up one or more energy levels compared to where it was originally. We talked about energy levels. Those are the shells, right? The lowest energy level is the one closest to the nucleus. Any given electron in a stable atom is going to be occupying the lowest level that it can. Right? When the first level fills, they have to go to higher levels, but any given electron is going to go as low as it can. That's the most stable situation. Well, when an atom gets excited, an atom of the pigment, one of those electrons goes higher in energy level. And that's what the energy goes into, right? The energy that is no longer there in photon form goes into sending that electron to a higher energy level. So no energy is created or destroyed. But an electron at a higher than possible level is a very unstable situation. And so it doesn't last there very long. The electron wants to go back down to as low an energy level as it can. It wants to go back to where it was before it got excited. So you can see the electron, E minus, going up to the excited state. That's a higher energy level, higher G, more instability. It wants to come back down, and it will, because it's able. But when it goes down back to where it started, that means it's losing energy, right? It's not destroying that energy. The loss of energy when it goes back down to the unexcited state means that a brand new photon, not the photon that was absorbed, that's gone, a brand new photon of light gets created. And that atom shines that photon away from itself. That is called fluorescence. All right. And that's why no energy is created or destroyed. The photon that leaves that atom is the energy that's lost when the electron goes back down. Okay, and if you have just trillions and trillions of chlorophyll, which is a pigment, chlorophyll molecules, not in a plant, just molecules in solution, like in this flask, and you shine light on it, those molecules will get excited, which means the electrons will go up and then back down, and they will shine light, those brand new photons. Well, that would be a total waste of time for a plant, A plant would never want that to happen with its chlorophyll. Because the whole idea of chlorophyll as a pigment in photosynthesis is to absorb the energy so that that energy can be put to use, right? The energy that's required to build a sugar, an organic compound, using carbon from CO2 comes originally from sunlight. It doesn't directly make that sugar, right? But you need to trap that energy that's in sunlight and use it for some work. Fluorescence would not do that. If the chlorophyll in plants were allowed to fluoresce when they get sunlight striking them, it would be a total waste of energy. It would just make the plant look very bright. This is why fluorescent paint is so bright. It's not reflecting. You know, if you look at the fluorescent paint on a speed limit sign when you're way out of town in the middle of the night, so it's dark, your headlights shine on it and it looks bright as hell. But it's not just because it's reflecting that light. The light of your headlight gets absorbed, and brand new light shines from the sun, from the sign, just like it would be if it were an electric light. That's why it's so bright. But plants don't want to do that, right? That's a waste. They want to capture the energy and then put it to work. So chlorophyll in a plant is complexed with proteins in such a way that fluorescence doesn't happen, so that that energy is not wasted. By the way, phosphorescence is a similar thing. Except that fluorescence is immediate. The electron immediately goes back down to the ground state. In fluorescence, it takes a little bit of time. So some of them are always coming down, but of the trillions and trillions that have been excited, it takes a while before they all come back down. And those are the things that we call glow-in-the-dark items. You have to load those things with light first. You're exciting the electrons, and then you turn the light off, and gradually some of them come back down, creating their own light. Anyway, plants don't do that, so let's look at how it happens in plants in slide 10. This membrane that you see a little bit of is not the plasma membrane. This is the thylakoid membrane, as you see labeled here. So keep in mind that the chloroplast has three named membranes, right? Has the outer membrane, the inner membrane, the thylakoid membrane. The thylakoid membrane makes up all the little coin-looking thylakoids. This is one little piece of that. And this is just one copy of millions of things embedded in the thylakoid membrane. We're looking at just one photosystem here. As we'll see, there are two types of photosystems, but there are millions of copies of each type, and we're looking at just one for simplicity. And it's a cutaway view. Kind of looks like a purple bell pepper. But it would actually wrap all the way around, this purpleness. The purple pieces that wrap all the way around the center are called light harvesting complexes. And they are mostly protein. But complexed in with the proteins are various pigment molecules, including chlorophyll A, chlorophyll B, and carotenoids that we talked about. And the fact that they are complexed with these proteins is what disallows fluorescence, which would be a total waste of the energy for the plant. It doesn't mean that the pigments can't be excited. They still get excited. They just don't fluoresce in response to that excitation. All right, so there's all kinds of different pigment molecules embedded in the light harvesting complex. The middle of this whole bell pepper looking thing, the photosystem, is called the reaction center complex. And it features a special pair of chlorophyll molecules that we'll talk about in a minute, but they're also pigment molecules and therefore can be excited. Okay, so let's see how this thing operates. Light is shining on this. Now, there's quadrillions and quadrillions of photons and even a tiny beam of sunlight. And most of those get wasted because they don't hit exactly on a chlorophyll or a pigment molecule anywhere. You know, those just go into either heating the plan up or bouncing off, reflected in a different direction or transmitted. But there's so many photons that there's always some photon striking pigment molecules.
It's not necessarily this one at the top. That's just the one that happens to be being hit first.
It doesn't matter which one gets hit by a photon. The point is the photon is absorbed. That photon is destroyed. And the energy goes into exciting that particular pigment molecule. All right? And that's when it would fluoresce if it weren't in a photosystem. But instead of fluorescing, one excited pigment molecule can send the excitation, basically, to a nearby pigment molecule. That's what the black arrows represent. And how this happens, let me get a darker marker, is beyond the scope of this course, but I'll just tell you the name of the process of how it happens. It's called resonance energy transfer. And what happens is that the excitation, which is energy, that excitation energy gets moved from one pigment to the next without photons being created. The photon originally from sunlight is destroyed and the excitation gets transferred from one pigment to the next. Well, it's going to bounce around to neighbors and eventually the excitation bounces to this reaction center complex. And I said this was a special chlorophyll in that reaction center. And that's because when it gets excited, it gets super excited in a sense, to the point that the electron totally leaves that chlorophyll. Notice the E minus in the arrow. That electron doesn't just go up an energy level, it totally leaves the chlorophyll. Meaning that it ionizes it, right? It's losing the electron. The electron is still there, of course, it doesn't get destroyed, it has to go somewhere. And where it goes is to another molecule that's part of this reaction center complex. That other molecule is called the primary electron acceptor. So if this happens, chemically speaking, how would you describe what's happening to the primary electron acceptor? It's becoming reduced. Exactly. It's receiving an electron from the chlorophyll. And that means that it has an electron that it can get rid of if it becomes reoxidized, right? Well, what other important things in the previous chapter were we talking about that became reduced temporarily and then got reoxidized? Right, the taxis. NAD and FAD become reduced when they receive electrons and they then can drop those electrons off. And where did they drop them off? To electron transport chains, exactly. And that's exactly what's going to happen here. The primary electron acceptor isn't going to hang on to this electron that it just received. It's going to pass it off to an electron transport chain. And for the same reason as well. This is in an entirely different process. We're in photosynthesis now. But it's going to feature an electron transport chain that, even though it is not made of exactly the same molecules, is going to operate for the same purpose. Let's go to slide 11 and look at this. I mentioned just a minute ago that there are two categories of photosystems in a plant. And there's millions of copies of each. But one copy of each type, plus electron transport chains that I'll mention in a minute, make up a functional unit, so to speak. So everything that we see in this slide is one functional unit for the light-dependent reactions, but there are millions of copies of this whole thing. the two categories of photosystems are reasonably enough called photosystem 1 and photosystem 2, but the confusing thing about this is that photosystem 2 operates first and then photosystem 1, which is kind of unfortunate, but the reason it's like this is simply because the first one to be discovered happened to be the second one to operate. So we named them in the order in which we discovered them. Photosystem 1 was discovered first, photosystem 2 later, but photosystem 2 operates first. So don't be confused by that. When I say the first photosystem, I'm really talking about photosystem 2. Okay, so you have one of each. You have photosystem 2, you have photosystem 1, and the membrane's not shown here, but all of this is embedded in the thylakoid membrane. And occurring between these two photosystems is also embedded in the membrane, is an electron transport chain. Now, it's not identical to the cellular respiration electron transport chain, meaning that the complexes aren't the same molecules, but it works exactly the same way. It receives electrons, passes them on to the next member, and so on. So think back to the previous chapter. The electron transport chains that operate in cellular respiration accomplish what directly?
Proton.
Yes. They use the electron transport, which is a release of energy, stepwise, to power the pumping of protons from one chamber to the other through the membrane, right? And that's exactly what's going to happen here. The detail is not shown in this cartoon. But as electrons trickle down through the electron transport chain, protons get pumped, and then protons come back through the membrane, down their gradient, to do what? What does the diffusion of protons directly accomplish in cellular respiration? Chemiosmosis, which is what happens in chemiosmosis. What happens to those protons? They diffuse, and where do they diffuse? They diffuse back to where they got pumped from, which means through that membrane, right? But where are they able to do that? That's the membrane. But where on that membrane are they able to get through? Right. Right. So the diffusion of protons directly accomplishes the turning of the rotors of the ATP synthase molecules, which results in phosphorylation of ADP into ATP. Right? The same exact thing is happening with this electron transport chain between the two photosystems. Now, all that detail is skipped in this cartoon, but you can see that ATP is being produced. That's how it's being produced. Exactly like it is in cellular respiration. Okay, now, the electron that gets trickled down through this electron transport chain comes from the primary electron acceptor in photosystem 2, in the first one. So keep in mind what we've already talked about. A photon comes along and hits in just the right place to excite one of these chlorophyll or carotenoid pigments. By resonance energy transfer, that excitation bounces around until it gets to the special chlorophyll in the reaction center complex, which gets so excited that it loses its electron to the primary electron acceptor and the electron and the primary electron acceptor then dumps it off immediately to the electron transport chain between these two photosystems. And as it goes down, protons get pumped and ATP gets produced as a result. Photosystem 1 is the second photosystem. And an entirely different photon from sunlight strikes one of these pigment molecules. And the same thing happens. The excitation bounces around until it reaches the reaction center complex chlorophyll there. And it loses its electron to its primary electron acceptor. And that primary electron acceptor dumps that electron off to a second, shorter electron transport chain, not between the photosystems, but after photosystem 1. And that shorter electron transport chain does not result in production of ATP. Instead, the electrons plus hydrogen ions from solution reduce NADP plus, the empty taxi for photosynthesis, into NADPH. Okay, so that's where the electrons end up, in NADPH, the electron from photosystem 1. Everything okay so far? Is that clear? Yeah.
So those two photosystems aren't necessarily like connected, they're just kind of occurring at the same time?
They are connected by their relationship with the electron transport chains. So they're in position. They have to be in position next to each other, basically.
So it does go from 2 to 1, like it actually looks better?
Well, that's what I was just about to get to. So the loss of an electron from either of these chlorophylls in either photosystem results in a very unstable situation. The chlorophyll that lost its electron really wants that electron back. It's not going to get that electron back. But all electrons are the same, so it doesn't care what electron it gets back, or it gets. It needs an electron to replace the one that it lost. Okay? Now, let's look at this on the second photosystem, which is photosystem 1. This chlorophyll lost its electron. It really wants one back. Well, it's going to get one back, namely the electron that trickles down through the electron transport chain between the two photosystems. It will replace the one that gets lost. So no problem there. All right? In photosystem 2, the first one, this chlorophyll has lost its electron, but it's not being delivered another electron from an electron transport chain the way the other one is. Instead, that electron has to come from a hydrogen atom that is part of water originally. So think back to the summary reaction, the inputs and outputs of photosynthesis. You need CO2. Well, that's an input in the second part that we haven't gotten yet. That's the light-independent reactions. But you also need water. That's the input for the light-dependent reactions, which is what we're looking at here. And the reason water is required is as an electron source. So you start with water. The electrons are really part of hydrogen atoms. And from that water, you first break that into hydrogens and oxygen. All right, you use the hydrogens as an electron source. The oxygen you get to get rid of. That's why oxygen is a byproduct of photosynthesis. It comes from the water that you're trying to get electrons from the hydrogen of. Okay, so it's just liberated here. But once you have the hydrogens, then the hydrogens get split into electrons and protons, and the electrons, one at a time, replace the one that is lost from this photosystem 2 reaction center pigment. Does that make sense? Is that a no? So So this electron that's being lost right here in this big arrow, that's never coming back. It just needs, this chlorophyll that just lost the electron just needs a replacement. The replacement comes from one of the electrons of one of the hydrogens in water that the plant is using. It splits the water into oxygen and hydrogen, gets rid of the oxygen, and the hydrogen gets split into proton and electron. The electron replaces the one that was just removed. On this photosystem one, the same thing is happening, except that water is not giving the electron directly here. The electron that's replacing this one first came from water, went up through this photosystem 2, trickled down through the electron transport chain, and then replaces this one. So they all come from water originally, but this is directly from water here first, and this is indirectly from water. And as long as light keeps shining on both of these photosystems, they'll both continue to be excited with electrons continuously replaced from more and more water, and both electron transport chains will be operating, and therefore you will produce ATP and NADPH, which are exactly the two energy-carrying molecules required for the second part of photosynthesis where the sugar is actually built. The light-independent reactions, which we're getting to, require both ATP and NADPH to force that endergonic set of reactions to happen, in which CO2, in inorganic form, the carbon gets incorporated into a sugar, which is an organic compound. So that's what these light-dependent reactions that we're looking at here are all about. Capturing energy of sunlight in the form of energy-carrying molecules, ATP and NADPH. Now, what I have just described for this setup that's in this slide, if all of that happens, in other words, that is called non-cyclic electron flow. All right, but just the fact that there's something called non-cyclic electron flow probably tells you that there's also a thing called cyclic electron flow that we'll get to in slide 13. But first, let's look at slide 12, just a cartoon that analogizes this process. The photons that are being absorbed are like these huge hammers that really excite these electron balls, right, up against gravity in this case. This is the primary electron acceptor. She spills it off the electron transport chain, which puts that energy into use, making ATP. Well, it also then can be excited in the next photosystem to go down a different chain to make NADPH. I don't know whether the cartoon helps you, but that's what it's kind of like. The point is, though, both of the energy-carrying molecules are produced in non-cyclic electron flow. ATP and NADPH. Now let's look at cyclic electron flow in slide 13. And some of this is dimmed out. That's to indicate that it's the same setup. It's the same photosystems and electron transport chains that are there. So I don't want you to think that some photosystem pairs operate for cyclic electron flow and some do for non-cyclic. Any of these functional units can operate for either cyclic or non-cyclic electron flow. It just switches back and forth. But why it's called cyclic electron flow is that the electron coming down through the electron transport chain between the photosystems doesn't get sent to the second electron transport chain. Instead, it just gets recycled back through the first electron transport chain for another ride through. Okay, the reason it goes up in energy is because it's still requiring sunlight striking photosystem one here. But the electron goes back through this chain instead of the second chain. And therefore, only the first electron transport chain is operating, and therefore, only ATP is produced, not NADPH as well. Now, why would you have such a thing? Because although it is true that the light-independent reactions, the Calvin cycle, where the sugar is actually built, require both of these molecules, ATP and NADPH, it does not require them in equal amounts. It actually requires, the Calvin cycle requires more ATP than NADPH. So you definitely have to have both. But notice that non-cyclic electron flow, which was when both electron transport chains are being used, produces exactly the same amount of ATP as NADPH. It makes it in a one-to-one ratio, in other words. Well, the next step is going to use more ATP than NADPH. So if you make them in equal amounts, you can look at it as either way. You can say that it's either making too little ATP or it's making too much NADPH, right? It's not the right ratio, which is wasteful. So that's why, as it needs to, this pair of photosystems will switch back and forth between cyclic and non-cyclic electron flow to make the ratio of these two molecules correct for the next part of photosynthesis. Now, the plant doesn't have to think about this. It just happens automatically. Why would suddenly non-cyclic electron flow be switched to cyclic electron flow? What would cause this to happen? No, there still needs to be water, because you still have to have... I see what you're saying. That's a good thought. But no, that's not what actually causes it. What would cause this second chain to shut down? Or look at it the other way around. What is required for that second chain to operate? Look at the picture. What's required? The chain itself is there. That's a requirement. Still there. So that's not the answer. What else besides the chain itself is required? What form?
Oxidized.
NADP plus, exactly. And so is an electron. Well, you have an electron, so that's also not the problem. You don't have NADP plus, maybe. Why would you not have NADP plus? Empty taxis. Because if you're only doing non-cyclic electron flow, you're making ATP and NADPH both. The next part is using up all of the ATP because it needs more of that than NADPH. And that means eventually you're just stockpiling NADPH way more than you need. Eventually, all of the NADP taxis, however many there are, will be in reduced form. They'll all be full taxis, right? There won't be any NADPH plus. And therefore, this chain just fills up. That's what shuts it off. Just like if you don't have oxygen in cellular respiration, the chain fills up, right? So when you're making not enough ATP and too much NADPH, the too much NADPH, which really means a lack of NADP+, will shut this down, and it will automatically switch into cyclic electron flow, because that's the only place where the electron can go now. and that will produce only ATP for a while until some of the NADPH gets used in the next part, and then we'll switch back and forth. You know, as soon as there's some empty taxis, it'll go back to non-cyclic electron flow. And the result is that the light-independent reactions, part two of photosynthesis, will get exactly the right ratio of the two kinds of energy-carrying molecules. Is that clear? Or does it make sense? Yeah.
What is
that? That's just a one of the several members of these chains. They're mobile members of the chains that are involved in the redox reactions. It stands for ferredoxin, but you don't have to know that.
Okay. And is it the same FD that would decide whether you're cytochrome or NADP plus, or is it like a different area? There's two FDs, one of them straight up?
Yeah, these FDs are able to move around, actually, unlike the huge complexes that are the pumps. That's why it's shown that way. Okay, let's look at 14. And compare the intermediate electron transport chain, by which I mean the one between the photosystems. That's the one that produces the ATP. And I said it's not exactly the same kinds of molecules that make them up in cellular respiration as in photosynthesis, but they operate for exactly the same reasons. So if you look at the box here on the bottom, that can represent either cellular respiration or photosynthesis electron transport. If it's a mitochondrion that you're representing by this box, then the darker gray space is the intermembrane space and the lighter gray is the matrix. And the pumps that are members of the chain pump protons from the matrix through the intermembrane to the intermembrane space, and then the protons diffuse back through ATP synthases to get back to the matrix, and in the process phosphorylate ADP to ATP. Well, in the chloroplast, it's exactly the same process. You just give different names to all these structures, right? The place where the protons get pumped to are the interior of the thylakoids. That's the thylakoid space. Then they diffuse back through ATP synthases to get back to the stroma, the stuff that's inside the inner membrane but outside the thylakoids. That's where the protons get pumped from, and that's where they diffuse back to in order to make ATP. Same process, just different protein complexes making up the chains. 15 puts this all together. This is a summary of the light-dependent reactions. So you can see one of these functional units, including photosystem 2 and photosystem 1 with electron transport chain between them, a shorter electron transport chain after photosystem 1. Light comes in, excites both photosystems. The reaction center complexes lose their electrons. The electron lost from photosystem 1 gets replenished by the electron trickling down through the intermediate chain. And the electron lost from photosystem 2 originally gets replenished by the splitting of water into oxygen and hydrogen. The hydrogens are no longer hydrogen atoms, they're electrons and protons. The oxygen is just waste gas. So in that process, which is what we're looking at here, is cyclic electron flow, both ATP, when the protons go back out into the stroma, is produced, and NADPH, exactly the two things that the Calvin cycle or light-independent reactions require to build the sugar. So that's what the light reactions accomplish. The light-dependent reactions accomplish the transduction. Transduction means to convert from one energy form to another. The transduction of light energy into chemical energy for use by part two, which is the light-independent reactions, which we now get to in slide 16. The Calvin cycle, of course, you can tell by the name, is a cycle. So just like the citric acid cycle, it's a pathway that wraps back around on itself. And it can continue to go through as long as you keep adding things. And that's because at a different part, you're taking things away, right? So for this to occur over and over, you have to both add and take off things. And this is where carbon fixation takes place. That's the big trick of photosynthesis. That's the part that no consumer can do, right? So this has as a material input CO2, inorganic carbon, in other words. And just like the citric acid cycle, since it's a cycle, you can think of it as having a start-finish line right up here at the 12 o'clock position. Remember that the citric acid cycle had something added right there. That was acetyl. Here you're adding something as well. It's the carbon dioxide that gets added at the start-finish line. Now, at the end of this, before it goes around again, you have a compound, it's one of the intermediates, a compound at the end, though, called ribulose bisphosphate, which is a sugar that it has two phosphates on it. That's why it's bisphosphate, bis meaning two. But it's a five-carbon sugar. All right? So it's a five-carbon sugar at the moment. Then a carbon dioxide comes in, gets incorporated. And that carbon dioxide, of course, has one carbon. So this five-carbon ribulose bisphosphate gets transformed by adding another carbon to it from CO2 into a six-carbon short-lived intermediate, which they're not even given a name here because it doesn't last long at all. As soon as it's produced, it's so unstable that it breaks into two of these three-carbon compounds. But notice that the CO2 was already, the carbon of the CO2, which is inorganic, has already been incorporated into an organic compound here. So carbon fixation happens right away in the Calvin cycle. I don't want to want you to memorize all these intermediates, just like I didn't for the citric acid cycle. But notice that overall, the cycle has three major phases because important things are happening. Phase one is carbon fixation itself. That's what I was just talking about. The carbon that's in CO2 gets incorporated into this six-carbon compound. That's carbon fixation. It's now organic. Then you have phase two, which is reduction. Well, you don't have reduction happen in isolation, right? You have to have something oxidized. In this case, it's reduction, though, of the intermediates, the members of the cycle. What becomes oxidized? NADPH. NADPH is reduced at the moment, right? That's the reduced form. When it loses its electrons, it reduces something else. So the intermediates in the cycle are being reduced. That's why it's phase two is called reduction. But the NADPH gets oxidized back into empty taxis, NADP+. Phase three is regeneration of the CO2 acceptor. Well, the CO2 acceptor is what accepts the CO2, of course, and that is ribulose bisphosphate. So to get to the point where you can keep incorporating more CO2, you have to change these intermediates along the way back into ribulose bisphosphate. Now, not only is NADPH used here, but notice ATP is used as well. But there's 9 ATPs that are required, 6 NADPHs. That's the ratio I was talking about. That's why you can't have only non-cyclic electron flow in the light-dependent reactions. You have to switch back and forth between non-cyclic and cyclic so that you supply the Calvin cycle with this correct ratio, 9 ATPs to 6 NADPHs, or a 3-to-2 ratio, prefer. Now, those are the three phases, but look at what's happening at the bottom. As this thing turns, every so often, a three-carbon sugar pops off. That carbon, I mean, that three carbon sugar is nicknamed G3P. It stands for glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. But that is the organic molecule that is the direct product of photosynthesis. When we talk about the reciprocal relationship between the complete oxidation of glucose and photosynthesis, we kind of say that glucose is the output of photosynthesis. That's, strictly speaking, that's not true. The direct output of photosynthesis is not a 6-carbon glucose. It's a 3-carbon glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. But once you have that, even though photosynthesis is over, once you have that already, then you can make glucose and other things out of that. Point is, you now have organic compounds where you didn't before, as CO2. And you can make all kinds of different things, not just glucose. But the direct output of the citric acid cycle is glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. Okay, now, an important thing that I didn't mention yet that's listed here is what's in this lavender box. Rubisco, which I prefer to... That's an acronym. But I prefer to spell it capital R-U... capital B, I, S, capital C, capital O. Because the full name is ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase oxygenase, as you may have guessed. So let's write that all out. Oops. And when you look at the whole name, you can tell what kind of thing this is, right? What is it? What kind of thing is this? It's an enzyme, right? Ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase oxygenase, or Rubisco, is not ribulose bisphosphate. Ribulose bisphosphate is this intermediate. The enzyme that allows for ribulose bisphosphate to accept another carbon from CO2 is Rubisco. And you can see its ASE endings telling you that it's an enzyme. But there's two ASE endings here, notice. It can act either, this enzyme can act either as a carboxylase or as an oxygenase. The plant wants it only to operate as a carboxylase. That means it's operating as a carboxylase if it accepts CO2 and sticks it on to ribulose bisphosphate. Okay? CO2 is like a carboxyl group. Just like decarboxylation produces a CO2, carboxylation takes a CO2 and sticks it onto something. And that's what the plant wants to happen. But unfortunately, this thing can also act as an oxygenase, which means it can take oxygen instead of CO2 and stick it onto ribulose bisphosphate. Plant does not want that to happen, but it has no choice. It's just chemically speaking, this is capable of both. That's a problem for the plant. Because if oxygen gets incorporated instead of CO2, that's bad for two reasons. Not only are you not incorporating any inorganic carbon, and you therefore won't make any sugar, that's a problem just by itself, right? Because the whole goal of photosynthesis is to make this sugar. Not only that, though, when you add an oxygen, you're right... to ribulose bisphosphate, you make something that's not a normal member of this cycle, and therefore you have to spend time and energy to transform it back into ribulose bisphosphate so you can do it the right way. So it's a waste of time, energy, and you don't make any sugar if oxygen is incorporated instead of CO2. Well, as it turns out, Rubisco is actually has a higher affinity for oxygen than it does for CO2. So if they're both present, which they are in the atmosphere, right? Then more often than not, oxygen will win, which is bad for the plant. And if that happens, this wasteful incorporation of oxygen instead of CO2, that's called photorespiration. The plant would like to avoid it, but many plants can't. And therefore, it just reduces their efficiency. Even if they're getting plenty of sunlight, they would have been able to make a lot more sugar given that sunlight if it weren't for the fact that oxygen interferes. And those plants that really haven't evolved any way around the problem are called C3 plants. But there are some groups of plants that have evolved solutions to this problem of photorespiration. And one group of plants that have come up with a solution are called C4 plants. That's what we're looking at in slide 17. First, though, think back. Imagine the slide I showed you when we were talking about leaves being kind of a sandwich. And the filling of the sandwich was a bunch of mesophyll cells, right, where the photosynthesis occurs. That's in a C3 plant. A C4 plant also has mesophyll cells, but in addition to those mesophyll cells, it has bundle sheath cells. And notice that the mesophyll cells are more superficial. They are situated closer to the atmosphere, to the epidermal layers. And the bundle sheath cells are deeper in the interior of the leaf, away from the atmosphere. On the right side, we have a cartoon of just one of each of these cells. The mesophyll cell on the top, the bundle sheath cell on the bottom. The solution to this problem of photorespiration is to separate carbon fixation from the Calvin cycle. In a C3 plant, carbon fixation happens at the Calvin cycle, right? That's where Rubisco operates. In a C4 plant, carbon dioxide gets fixed first, and then Calvin cycle operates after that. So there's a separation of carbon fixation and Calvin cycle. Well, C4 plants have done this separation of these two things spatially, meaning that the separation is in different compartments, these two different kinds of cells. The mesophyll cell is the one that's close to the atmosphere. It's at the edge of the leaf surface. That's where oxygen and carbon dioxide both are, right? But this first cycle at the top is not the Calvin cycle. This is a separate cycle that C4 plants do. And the carbon fixation occurs efficiently because the enzyme responsible for fixing the carbon into this cycle is not Rubisco, it's PEP carboxylase, which is not affected by oxygen. So it doesn't matter how much of the oxygen is around here in this cell, which is by the oxygen in the atmosphere, because oxygen doesn't work for this enzyme. Only CO2 does. That's where the carbon dioxide gets fixed. And the intermediates that are part of this cycle get transformed from one to the next. But notice that there is then a transfer through plasmodesmata to this deeper cell that's away from the atmosphere. And the carbon that came from CO2 is in these intermediates at the moment, right? But then the CO2 comes back out. It gets decarboxylated. The intermediate gets decarboxylated into the bundle sheath cell and incorporated by the Calvin cycle by Rubisco. But by the time it's deep in the cell, it doesn't matter that it's Rubisco and because this is away from the oxygen. And therefore, this drastically increases the efficiency of the Calvin cycle because of the separation in space into two different compartments. Any questions on that? That avoids photorespiration. Not entirely, but it drastically cuts it down. Yeah.
So is that like a very specific type of plant?
No, it's not just one species. It's a huge group of plants, but there's plenty of plants that are C3 and can't do anything about the wastefulness of photorespiration. That's one solution to the problem. But 18 compares C4 on the left, which we just looked at, to another group that solved it a different way. Those are called CAM plants. CAM is another acronym. It stands for crassulation acid metabolism. Now, that word crassulation is the name of a group of plants that are capable of doing this, but they're not the only plants capable of doing this. The reason that this process was called CAM originally is because the first plants that we discovered that could do this were crassulations. Other plants can do this, and therefore they're doing the same thing as crassulations. But anyway, the acid metabolism part of it refers to the fact that this cycle involves organic acids. But just like I was talking about for C4, that there needs to be a separation of carbon fixation from the Calvin cycle, rather than doing it carbon fixation in the Calvin cycle itself, you separate them. C4 separated it into space, two different cells. But a CAM plant separates it in time. There's a temporal separation instead of a spatial separation. Temporal means in time. It's the same cell, but carbon fixation happens at a different time compared to Calvin cycle. In these CAM plants, what they do is close their stomata, which are the openings in the leaves, right? That's how oxygen and CO2 can get through the surface of the leaf. They close those down during the day. Now, unrelated to this, that's actually beneficial for a totally different reason. Because these CAM plants tend to live in hot places. And if you have your stomata open during the day, which normal C3 plant would have, because that's when it needs the CO2, when the light is shining, if it's a hot place and you're opened up, that means you're going to lose a lot more water by evaporation. And loss of too much water, of course, can kill you. So it has the advantage, for a different reason, that closing off the stomata in a CAM plant will save it from dehydration. But the reason it's doing it with respect to photosynthesis is that it doesn't want O2 to come in. All right? Now, the separation is temporal, I said. At night, CO2 gets incorporated, it gets fixed by this first cycle into organic acids. That's why it's called acid metabolism. So the CO2 that gets fixed is currently in the form of these organic acids. And that just happens all night, basically. So more and more carbon gets incorporated into organic acids. Then at dawn, the next day, the stomata open and the CO2 that was incorporated the night before in the organic acids gets released and sent to the Calvin cycle. Or, I'm sorry, the next day the stomata closed. Not open. They're open at night. They're closed during the day. Right? So during the day, they block off oxygen. They, of course, block off CO2 from the atmosphere as well, but it doesn't matter because the CO2 got incorporated into organic acids the night before. And then just gradually throughout the day, more and more CO2 comes off these organic acids, and that supplies the Calvin cycle without interference from oxygen. So it's a temporal separation of the two processes rather than a spatial separation. Either way solves the problem of photorespiration, though. And therefore, these plants are a lot more efficient in terms of how much G3P or sugar they can produce within a given amount of time, with a given amount of sunlight. Well, 19 is the final slide of the unit, and it's just a summary, so there's really no new information here. Looks very similar to one we already looked at when we start before we started talking about it. This shows overall summary of photosynthesis. Recall that photosynthesis occurs entirely within a chloroplast. There's no part that starts in the cytosol like there was in the complete oxidation of glucose. It's entirely within chloroplast. The Calvin cycle is the second part, but that's where the carbon fixation and the production of sugar occurs. And it should make sense to you, given all we've said about the different kinds of reactions, that making a complex carbohydrate out of, a sugar, which is a complex molecule compared to a simple CO2, is going to be an expensive process, right? It's endergonic and therefore requires energy in some form. Well, the energy does come from sunlight, but not directly. The only usable form of energy that the Calvin cycle can use is these two chemicals, ATP and NADPH. It has to have both, so lacking one will shut it down. But these two things, ATP and NADPH, are exactly what's produced in the first part, the light-dependent reactions, using light directly to excite the photosystems and therefore transfer electrons, producing ATP with one electron transport chain and producing NADPH with the other electron transport chain. These high-energy molecules then get spent in the Calvin cycle to produce the sugar. And when you spend ATP, that dephosphorylates it back into ADP, an inorganic phosphate. When you spend NADPH, that reoxidizes it back into NADP+. Both of those lower energy molecules then go back to the light-dependent reactions to get recharged. NADP+, back into NADPH. ADP, an inorganic phosphate, back into ATP, so that it can keep supplying the Calvin cycle for more and more sugar. Now, you not only need light for this, but you also need water, because, as I said, water is a source of electrons for that electron transfer to happen. And when you split the hydrogens off of water to get the hydrogens, you also produce oxygen as a byproduct. As far from the viewpoint of just photosynthesis, that's a total waste, oxygen. But of course, a plant has a chloroplast or chloroplasts and mitochondria. So the oxygen that's produced as a byproduct of photosynthesis can end up helping the plant with its mitochondria for the purpose of cellular respiration. It's doing both of the processes, complete oxidation of glucose and photosynthesis. We're doing just one of those, right? We have to eat for our food, but the molecules we get out of that serve as fuels that can be broken down by cellular respiration. Any questions before I stop recording? Yeah. Because they came, the ancestor to plants got. No. It definitely is used for exactly the same reason we do. They can't survive without their mitochondria. But both mitochondria and chloroplast originated because of endosymbiosis, remember. So you had an ancestor originally, a eukaryotic cell that didn't have either, engulfed first a bacterium that was capable of cellular respiration. That became the original mitochondria. All right, and that is our ancestor. We animals have mitochondria, but not chloroplasts. A little bit later, a cell that already had a mitochondria engulfed a photosynthetic bacterium, and that became the first chloroplast. And that's the ancestor to plants. They have both. And they therefore can do both of the reciprocal processes. Does that answer it? Anything else? Well, then don't forget a Scantron, and don't enjoy the weekend.